Welcome back to Senate Finance. It's about 5:20, and we are resuming from our morning meeting. We're going to hear a presentation from Analytica. SB 138 is the topic, and you're going to do some work for us regarding cash flows. If you two gentlemen want to come back up. Present at the table are Senator Meyer, Senator Hoffman, Senator Dunleavy, Senator Fairclough, myself, Senator Kelly. Senator Olson is going to join us momentarily.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Nico Stafos, a partner at Analytica. I'm going to skip through my bio. We have five slides to present to you today, so hopefully we can keep this brief. And we want to talk about cash calls, cash flows, and impact on oil revenues. There's two slides for the first, two slides for the second, and one slide on the last one. And in particular, we wanted to devote the first section, cash calls, to talk about two different ideas. And this sort of complements some of the analysis you saw this morning by Department of Revenue in terms of how to think about these different phases and the different calls on the states' cash. And what we wanted to show you is this slide is a base case. The next slide is a stress case. We'll talk about what a stress case, how we've defined it. So this is a slightly busy slide, but it's sort of one of those slides that once we work through it, hopefully it illuminates quite a bit. So we have four sort of groups of bars: pre-feed, feed, construction, and online. Pre-feed, feed, and construction are all sort of cumulative numbers. The online number is an annual number, and this is in millions of dollars, or billions of dollars if you want to take out the three zeros. And we try to show for each one of these four phases, pre-feed, feed, construction, and when the project is online, four different numbers. The green says no TransCanada, so basically the world of the HOA, and no debt. You're paying everything out of pocket. The yellow still has no TransCanada, but assumes that you will finance 70% of your share with debt. The red is an option that has TransCanada with the buyback, and this basically is 40% of the 25% in the treatment plant and the pipeline. And the blue-purple at the end is a world where TransCanada has 100% of the GDP in the pipeline. And so that's a world where the state only has a 25% share in the liquefaction. Okay. And so the first thing that obviously when you step back, which is something we've pointed out before, is that really the construction part really stands out in terms of where the money is being spent. But you can also see in each one of the phases, the range between the different options. So the first phase, you're talking anywhere from $55 to $105 million. You're talking about the feed phase, basically the no TransCanada options. The state could be spending something like $500 million, and obviously these are estimates. If you were to not exercise your buyback option, that could be coming down to under $300 million, a little bit over, in fact, $250 million. That's in effect the delta, the gap between those two numbers is what TransCanada will be paying as part of the feed study. And the key thing before we go to construction is those bottom points, the traffic lights. And this is quite crucial, and we've covered this in the past, but I think it was useful to see it in this holistic picture, that at the end of the pre-feed study, you in effect have three options. You and actually the other partners have three options. You can abandon the project. You can, at the end of the pre-feed study, you can look at the numbers and say, this is just not going to work, and you call it quits. And at that time, you have to reimburse TransCanada because TransCanada was paying for your share of the project. There's a second option that says, okay, we like the project, but we're still not quite sure about whether we want to have as big of a share as we started. So you could adjust your share by selling down some of the equity. And there's a third option, the green option, which says, let's proceed and authorize the next tranche of cash, which is the number on the top, then the 486, 486, 417, and 266, depending on the scenario. So at the end of the feed phase, which lasts probably about 2-3 years, you have again three possible pathways. You can at that point decide to abandon the project, in which case you will also be liable to compensate TransCanada for the money that they were spending on your behalf, plus interest. You can also at that time or at any time in between decide to adjust your equity share from 25% to something lower or higher, depending on your appetite. You can also at the end of the FEED study said, we like it, we like everything that's going on, let's proceed to the final investment decision. And then once you get to the construction phase, obviously then the cash outlays become significantly bigger, almost $12 billion if you assumed no role for TransCanada and no debt whatsoever, falling down to anywhere from $5 billion to $3.5 billion. All of these assume 70% debt coverage, debt contribution, and then their range depends on what TransCanada does. And at that point, it's generally too late to abandon the project. Once you've taken final investment decision, you don't just stop because you're starting to spend some very serious money, and for the most part, you want to see it through. But you can still at any point decide to adjust down your share. We came to this committee a few weeks ago and we talked about Queensland Curtis LNG in Australia and how much its equity ownership had changed over time. And at that point, during the construction phase, you're effectively on the hook for covering whatever share, whatever your share is of the project cost. If project costs go up, you have to cover your share, whether that's 25% across or 25% of the liquefaction and a portion of the GDP in the pipeline. And then on the plus side, on the online revenue side, and again, this is just to clarify, purely gas, so we're not including any oil, whether it's from Point Thompson or Prudhoe Bay, condensates, this is purely gas. The annual revenues are anywhere from $2.9 to almost $4 billion. And as you would expect, if you don't spend any, if you don't take on any debt, the green, you make the most amount of money because you don't have to, you don't have to repay any debt. If you have the same scenario but you've taken on debt, that $500 million or so difference is basically what you're paying back the banks. If you then go down to scenarios with TransCanada, the deltas are essentially what you're paying TransCanada, because TransCanada fronted the money and you're paying them back with a tariff. So this is, again, as I said, it's a slightly heavy, busy chart, but we think that when you step back and you sort of look at it, it's a compelling visual display of all the different phases, all the different cash commitments, but also the variation depending on the type of partnership that you choose, especially vis-a-vis TransCanada, but also in the first and second case in relation to whether you want to finance this purely through equity or also through debt. So that's the base case. Now let's talk a little bit scarier numbers to go to slide 5, which is a stress case. So we wanted to really stress the stress case, not to scare you, but to give you a sense of what does a bad scenario look like. And in general, when you look at the economics of LNG projects, there are three things that we feel most impact the project economics. Now, there are other things, clearly, but we chose these three because these are the most important ones, we thought. The first is that the project could cost more. And this affects the economics in two ways. It affects the economics because obviously you have to put more money up front today or during the construction phase. But it also means, especially if you're assuming that whatever the cost, you're going to be financing with 70% debt. If the cost is higher, you're taking on more debt that you then have to repay. Right. So that's a capital expenditure stress. The second thing is assuming a much lower sales price. We were down to $7 MMBTU. This was coming in part from Senator Meyer, who was asking us about $7. So we thought, let's use that as a stress case. Don't read any particular forecast or supply and demand curves and anything to that number. That's really a stress case. And in fact, if you look at Japan and Korea right now, or there's almost no LNG that's flowing to these countries at $7. So it's really way outside of today's market conditions. And the last part was utilization. Now, utilization, the way to think about that was to try to understand the impact most often of one-off events. What if you had to shut down the plant for 2-3 months? The idea that you would overall build a project and only run it at 80% is generally unlikely. The places that usually run at below 100% utilization tend to do so because they don't have sufficient gas, which is unlikely to be the case here, or because they're diverting the gas to the local market. Again, unlikely you'll have a big enough market for that to happen. It generally doesn't happen for a design reason. We talked one example of Schnovit. It's a project that had to shut down every few months in order to do repairs. So there are a number of reasons why it could get you to an 80% utilization, but it's really meant as a 1 year rather than as a 25-year stress test. So let's then go down to the numbers. And there are four clusters. The first and the third are the same as the previous chart. They're the base case construction and the base case revenues. Okay. We've taken out the pre-feed and the feed because cost escalation there is probably not going to make or break these economics. So in the first two clusters, we're seeing basically what does a 25% higher capex do to the cash calls. So it increases from $11.8 billion to $14.7 billion in the no debt case and no TransCanada case. And in the other cases, it increases anywhere from $1.2 billion, which is the first, sort of the blue, the yellow. I'm just reading 4.9 and 6.2. That's about $1.2 billion of a delta. About $1 billion of a delta if you have the buyback with TransCanada, and a little bit less than $1 billion of a delta if TransCanada were to own 100% of the GDP in the pipeline. So again, this is just answering the question, okay, what if the project costs were higher? And then we go to the revenue side. And I want to stress that this stress case is additive. So all three things are happening at the same time. So you have higher costs, lower prices, and lower utilization. Okay? So you're kind of are talking about, in LNG terms, a perfect storm of everything going wrong for you. What does that look like? So you can see on the revenue side, you're looking at a case where you might go from $4 billion of revenue to $1.6 billion of revenue in the sort of no TransCanada, no debt case. You know, 3.5 to a little bit under $1 billion in the no TransCanada but leveraged world, $3.2 billion to $700 million, and then the lower case, $2.9 billion to $500 million. So what do these numbers tell us? They tell us a couple of things. First, they underscore a point that we've made throughout, and you heard Larry Perlstein talk about this morning, that LNG projects generally don't lose money. But if you were to put down the equivalent of, $14 or $15 billion in order to get annually $1.6 billion back, that probably would not be a wise investment given the time value of money. But as you can see, even in the lowest of cases, you're still, at least in this scenario, and again, this is a stress case, you're still not cash flow negative. You still aren't getting to the point where you have to tap into the reserves of the state in order to cover your obligations under this project. In other words, for you to get to that point where you're either generating zero cash back to the state or actually having to take money out of the state treasury into the project, the scenario would have to be worse than the parameters that we're showing here, which means either capex escalation should be more than 25% and prices should be below $7 and utilization should be below 80%. Right? So that gives you a sense of what will it really take in order for this thing to turn to turn negative, which is generally quite a bit. But again, the core point is maybe you won't make as good of a return on your money, and that's really the way to think about this project. Okay? I'll turn it over to Janik.
Thank you. For the record, Janik Mayer, partner with Analytica. I'd add, before going on to the next slide, one more thought to Nikos's commentary on this slide, which is a reminder that in all of the cases...
Janik, can I stop you just for a second? Senator Dunleavy, did this answer your question from this morning?
I'm still processing. I'm going through some notes here.
Okay. Go ahead, Janik.
In all of the cases here that involve some degree of debt, in other words, all of the cases other than the green one, those cash flows are similarly net of debt payments. So after not only the operating costs and all those other costs that are ongoing costs of the project have been met, but also after the yearly debt payments on both principal and interest have been met, these are then the net cash flows that occur after that. So,
okay. And let me just, for purposes of getting my head around this, so that's underutilized, low prices, $7-ish, 25% overruns on your project. What was the fourth one?
That was it, three.
The three, okay. I think that meets what you were talking about this morning, Senator. Go ahead, Senator Dunleavy.
Sure. So, through the chair, so we're looking at $7 as a low?
Yes. Do you don't think that's low enough?
I didn't say that. But what is it now?
Through the chair, for the record, Nikos Tsafos, Senator Dunleavy. The answer is it depends where.
What's right? The lowest now that you're aware of?
The lowest now you can say is Henry Hub, right? Which would probably be right now about $5. But that's not a relevant price.
That's not LNG.
For this project.
LNG,
if I were to think of for the last 5-6 years of LNG going into Asia that is below $7 MBTU, I can think off the top of my head about three contracts that were signed in the early 2000s that meet that criteria. One of them probably doesn't meet it anymore because it had an escalator. The rest of the gas in Asia, which is 70% of the market, trades way, way above $7. So the other way to think about it is when you look at Henry Hub, so let's take a low Henry Hub price. Let's go to $3. And let's talk about Asian buyers that are trying to take these $3 Henry Hub and bring them to Japan. So in the lowest of cases, which probably is not on the table anymore, British Gas signed a contract with Cheniere, and the formula was you took that $3 gas, you added 15%, so $3 plus 15% is 45 cents, so 345. They added $2.25 for the liquefaction, right? So you're already at high fives, 560, 570. And then depending on the transport cost, if you have a Panama Canal or not, you would probably go above $7. So even in a $3 Henry Hub world, if you put all the costs of the cheapest infrastructure out there as a contract to get to Asia, you would still be above $7. So that was the reason I said that Henry Hub price is not relevant, because by the time you add all the cost of Henry Hub to Asia, you would still be above $7. The last comment I would say about $7, a sustained environment of $7 in today's gas market would probably price out of the market over 50, 60, 70% probably of the proposed LNG supply. If you said the price, everyone can only get $7 into Japan, that would probably wipe out East Africa, it would probably wipe out Western Canada, big parts of the lower 48, definitely Russia. There isn't that much supply out there that could really continue to flow to keep that price that low. And that's why, even though it came from Senator Maya, the number, the reason we used it is because we do think it's a really aggressive stress case. Now, is it possible that it could be lower? Absolutely. It was 15 years ago. But in terms of where the market is now, we would say that's a pretty good stress case.
Senator Dunleavy?
Can I have just a quick timeout?
Really?
Exactly. So we talked about every 3 or 4 years we may have some review clauses.
Thank you, everybody.
Everyone got their questions answered there. Go ahead. No, Senator Meyer?
I don't know if Senator Denling was done. Were you done?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do think $7 as a worst-case basis is very legit. As you mentioned, Henry Hub is somewhere between $3 and $5 currently, and you mentioned that there were some contracts back in 2000 at $7. And as you know, back in 2000, we didn't have near the supply that we have now, especially with all the oil shale and the Lower 48 and what they're finding in Qatar and Australia and Canada. And it seems like they're finding gas everywhere. So my concern is that there's a lot more supply out there. Now, hopefully, there's more demand to eat up some of that supply. And hopefully, that supply is coming from high-cost areas that our gas will still be competitive. And somewhere in the charts here, I'm sure there is a supply and demand graph, and I just can't remember where because we've had so many. I agree. I hope it's not at 7, but I think that's good. That's an eye-opener for us to see this.
Before you leave, could you point out that supply and demand graph that Senator Meyer's talking about, if you could get that to us? I know it's in here.
It's in here somewhere.
Yeah.
It's gotta be.
Go ahead. Resume with your presentation.
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, if I could just make one comment. This is Nico Tsafos for the right hand. On the supply-demand chart, I think the key part to understand, so we, just like everyone else, sees demand increasing. And usually when you do the supply-demand graph, you start off with what's contracted and then what's preliminary contracted, and then you have a gap of what's, in effect, up for grabs. And the point is that for the window that you're looking at, which is sort of the early 2020s, maybe even mid-2020s, there's no one really that is even marketing to that window. And that's one of the key benefits, is that you may think you're competing with Western Canada and West and East Africa, and in some ways you are, but when we talk, and I had the pleasure of working with quite a few of these companies, when you talk to the companies that are involved in East Africa and they're going to conferences trying to sell LNG, they're not trying to sell LNG for 2024. They're trying to sell LNG for 2019 and 2020. So in that sense, there is a supply-demand chart, but because you're further out, there isn't really much competing supply there. It's all way speculative anyway. But we can try to get you some of these numbers to see them, how they look.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Fairclough, what was that tab again?
Well, I was on 8, Mr. Chairman, for alignment, but that's not it. Now I'm on 10. It was actually a chart that showed the Asian markets, and it had gas sales from somewhere between $10 and $17 per MCF. I know I saw it in resources. I'm trying to find it here.
Go ahead. We'll find it while you're riffing. Go ahead.
Senator Fackler, through the chair, I think if you look at the initial presentation we gave before LBNA, if you have that chart is definitely in that deck.
Great. That was our first one.
Yes.
I just don't know where the secretaries put it, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, we can find out later.
Okay. LNG overview, maybe? No.
Tell you what, we have people that can do this. Why don't you guys go ahead and continue what you're doing?
Bruce, if you could find that for us.
Thank you.
So to move to the next slide, this is a revised version of a chart that we've presented previously before this committee. Once again, we simply wanted to present it going down to some lower price levels again. Senator Meyer had asked to see what this would look like if we extended this down to prices below $10. In this case, we've gone down to 8 simply because for a number of technical reasons with the model, it was easier to go to 8 than to 7. But you can see very quickly the fundamental dynamic here, which is so the green line represents the status quo, essentially. If the state of Alaska continues, we're able to have a project and we're able to continue to tax it based on value at the wellhead net of costs at the same 35% profit-based tax rate that exists at the moment. What that would look like in terms of total cash over the project life to the state of Alaska at a range of different prices. The red and the yellow represent, by contrast, going in kind with equity at either a 20 or 25% share. And so what you see there is that, you know, in a world of LNG prices at the sort of range that, that we are at the moment, the sort of $15 to $17, $18 range, actually in those circumstances, if it were possible to have a project and have that go ahead while sticking with the current structure, that would actually look pretty good. And that it looks pretty good at those prices in undiscounted terms, so it would look even better if you were to look at this taking into account the time value of money, because state outlays would be relatively little and there'd be a lot of cash generated. But what you see is that as you look down to those lower prices, the value embodied by that green line, the value of being the taxing authority at the wellhead rather than the in-kind participant, falls away very, very quickly. And the reason it does that is what we've stressed a number of times so far, which is the question of when all you are is a taxing entity at the wellhead, most of the value lies in the fixed claims embodied by tariffs throughout the rest of the system. And because those are fixed, because those stay the same no matter what the LNG price is, as the LNG price comes down, the impact of those fixed claims is to magnify the impact of the falling price onto the value to the state. So that while the sort of status quo in value, if it were possible to achieve, looks pretty good at current LNG prices, in a world of lower LNG prices, that looks much less favorable to the state than the world of in-kind with equity. Correspondingly, the counter is true of what happens to producers and to the federal government. We've similarly redone a slide we presented before on sort of overall government take and of the different stakeholders in this project, who gets what levels of cash, both again to go down to some prices below $10 per MMBTU landed into Asia, and also to revisit the sort of producer wedge of the slide to emphasize, and we had some discussion about this the last time we appeared before committee, the fact that when we talk about the producers, there are three separate producers there. And it's easy to think that when one talks about a 25% stake in this project for the state of Alaska, that the state, by taking a 25% share, would be capturing 25% of the value, and most of the value going to the producers. In fact, as you see here, in all worlds, but in different cases, value to the state of Alaska is much more than a quarter of the total value of the project. What we have on the y-axis of these charts is the overall percentage split of cash flows to the project. So what you're seeing, in fact, so if you add the green and the blue bars, what you're seeing is essentially the total undiscounted government take by both state and federal government. And you can see that in the status quo world, that hovers a bit below or a bit above 50%. And remember, of course, this is looking at government take across the entire project, not just to the upstream component. So you would expect that number to be much lower than equivalent numbers that one has seen for oil in previous years, where we're looking just at the upstream, which is the most heavily taxed component. What you see, of course, as well is, again, on the left, if we're looking at in value, government being the taxing authority at the wellhead in Alaska, you get a good share of the value to the state at current LNG prices in the sort of 15 and in particular up toward the $18 per barrel range. But what you see here in particular is just how markedly the share of the total project cash going to the state of Alaska falls away as the price decreases when you're a taxing authority of the wellhead, because all of the value is taken up by those other fixed claims on the project, and the remaining value at the wellhead is very little, whether that's being taken in royalty or whether that's being taken in production tax. By contrast, what you see in the in-kind and equity world, whether you have a 20% share or a 25% share, is as the price goes down, in fact, the overall proportion of the value come to the state of Alaska is actually relatively higher. And in all cases, but particularly in the 25% equity case, you see that not only is the state getting substantially more than a 25% share of the overall project, they look much more in terms of the total value across all those prices. The green area is much closer to the area of all three producers than to one producer in that sense. The state may just be a 25% shareholder in the project, along with three other shareholders that have somewhere between 20 and 30 something percent each. But overall, the share of value that it captures, precisely because it's not a taxpayer for most purposes, is much more like all three producers combined. Finally, we had a question about impact of upstream capital spending on gas and what impact that has specifically on production tax revenues from oil. As SB 138 is written at the moment, while gas moves to a gross-based tax for which there is no deduction of costs, all costs on all upstream spending, whether for oil or gas, are deductible against the profit-based tax on oil. So the question is, how much of an impact could upstream costs associated with developing the gas project have on the revenues that the state would otherwise receive in the years that development is going on from oil? And the answer to that is obviously that it depends a lot, for instance, on how much upstream capital is spent. Here we've assumed a base case of $3 billion in pure upstream capital and a higher case of $4.5 billion in pure upstream capital. And what you see is, generally speaking, depending on how much spending is going on, between $250 and $350 million a year being reduced from the revenues that the state would otherwise forecast having in those years as a result of those costs being written down against the oil tax liability. We've included here both production tax and royalty, but none of the other elements of, for instance, state income tax, property tax, etc. It is conceivable that there would be a further impact on state income tax. That would depend a lot on how depreciation of all of the capital that was being built on this enormous project worked, and whether it was possible for producers to claim depreciation for some of those assets before the liquefaction project was put in service. In other analyses that we've done, where we show a total impact to the state of more than the sort of $1.5 billion across 4 or 5 years that you see here, and closer to $1.9 billion, we've conservatively included an impact on state income tax as well. Here, because we were asked specifically on the impact on the revenues that come specifically from oil, from royalty and from production tax, we looked just at that component. And you can see while there is certainly an impact, it's not remotely one that would severely take away the revenues that the state receives from oil. That concludes our deck for this evening, but we are very open to questions if there are.
Lady. Ready?
Through the chair. Thank you. Two questions. In your professional opinion, are there any changes to this legislation that you would advise?
Through the chair, for the record, Nico Safa, Senator Dunleavy. Let's brainstorm. My sense is, I would probably start out at 25%. I would probably max out the tax to get to 25% equity, and then work down if I, over time, decided that I didn't want as much. That would be one thing. I would, and I'm saying I because it's sort of, Janik may have different views. I'm just kind of thinking out loud here. I think it would be useful to have a little more clarity on HDC, and in particular whether you're going to be spending money in parallel for an LNG project at an in-state line, and whether or not how coordinated those two expenditures and streams are, because my understanding, I was listening to last week, you know, the funding that's available for the in-state lines. So I would like to think about how those two streams of cash are going to be related. When looking at the fiscal notes, I was noticing the things that were in there. One of the things I noticed, and I recognize the irony of me saying that, because I am a consultant, there was some money for consultants. My sense is, and maybe it's too soon for that, I would just staff up and really start saying, you know, if we're going to do this, State of Alaska should have a number of people for whom this is their day job, and they're starting to gear up to represent the state in all the negotiations, because it's a great opportunity to develop a permanent staff with great expertise in gas and LNG. Some thoughts, yeah.
For the record, Janik Mayer, Analytica. I would agree with all the points my colleague Nikos raises. I think the only other thing, and this may not necessarily be a question of specific language for the bill necessarily, but if for instance, thinking from the perspective of if I were a legislator, I think the other thing that I would want assurance on is really understanding what the envisioned process from here is in terms of the contractual negotiation process, what executive session briefings look like, how often those are likely to be occurring, because I think everyone involved in this process knows that when the end result comes, the only way that everyone involved is comfortable with what's been negotiated is if there's been very regular feedback along the way and people have had a chance to get comfortable with how negotiations are going and not feeling like they're blindsided at the end. So I think it's clearly critical to make sure that one is comfortable with having a sense of how that's likely to play out, and that that's going to play out in a way that you're comfortable with.
Can I just go ahead, one second? Sorry, Nico Stafos for the record. Just one more thing to add. The other thing, and it's not necessarily a thing to change, but it's a thing to understand a little bit better. There are ways to read the MOU with TransCanada that it seems that if this project were to get stalled or to be a no-go, the state might still be compensating TransCanada for the study expenses. So I just want to understand a little bit better the termination clauses of the MOU, and you know, if the termination were not because the state wanted to terminate something, but because the project was effectively being terminated, whether the state of Alaska should still be liable to compensate TransCanada. So again, I'm not quite sure, because I'm not a lawyer, what the precise provisions are right now, but that's something I would like to understand a little bit better in terms of exactly. I mean, it's one thing to say, you know, if you kick out a partner, you should be on the hook to pay things, but if a project kind of falls apart through no fault of your own, how you allocate that risk, that's something I would like to understand.
Senator Dunleavy?
Two quick additional questions and just a very brief statement. Next one. If you were in my position, would you vote for or against this bill?
Senator Dunleavy, through the chair, and I don't mean to be evasive in response to the question, I don't want to sort of overstep the line of policy advice rather than analysis. What I would say in response to your question is when we sit down and look through the fundamental problems and challenges that have to be addressed to get a project happening, I think we are very clear, A, that a large-scale export project is in the best interests of Alaska, that there are a number of difficulties in making it happen, and that there are a limited number of ways to resolve those difficulties, and that in terms of the broad structure, whether it's equity, participation, gas in kind, all of the rest, the core components of this as ways of addressing those problems, I think make a lot of sense to both of us. And when we sit down and think about what other ways could one have resolved these problems, well, we can think of a couple, but I don't know that we've thought of any that are compellingly better than the ones that are in front of you.
And for the record, through the chair, if I could add one more non-answer to your question. In my years at PFC Energy, I have studied or worked on a large number of LNG projects, and there are a lot of projects that my gut reaction after either 5 minutes or 5 weeks of spending time with the projects was to say, this ain't going to happen. That's not the reaction I have after spending a month and a half here in Juneau. There isn't something that you look at that we've seen that says, my God, this is just, you know, it's kind of like this big minefield or landmine in the middle of the project. We haven't detected that.
One last question in a statement.
Senator Dunleavy?
It's a large project. It's going, the pipeline's going great distances. We've had earthquakes here in the past. 2002, for example, we had earthquakes in the eastern side of the state that was, I think, the second largest in recorded history in North America at 7.2 or 7.4. I would imagine there's insurance out there in the market that one can look at for large-scale projects such as this. You get the pipeline and the plant's almost complete, and all of a sudden there's a, you know, there's a catastrophe such as an earthquake. Am I correct in the insurance concept?
Senator Dunleavy, through the chair, and my colleague Nikos may have another answer to that. Generally, what I'd say is, for most things, insurance is available for most risks, and including catastrophic ones like earthquakes. When you start getting to a project the size of this one and $65 billion, insurance markets get less and less efficient the bigger the size of the potential capital exposure, and even more so when you combine high magnitude outcome in terms of the capital at risk and low probability of outcome. Knowing what an efficient price is for that insurance and having that be an efficiently priced product, I think, is the difficulty that you have in trying to get insurance. All of those questions, though, in terms of understanding the magnitude of that risk and how that's best mitigated technically, are going to be things that the partners are going to really need to understand as they go, in particular, through the FEED process. FEED is the time for all of those very detailed things to be understood in at the most minute level.
And then the statement.
Go ahead.
Through the chair, can we get from the individuals I guess it's a question to you, just a list of what would be some suggestions or recommendations they would advise us to take a look at as we go down this road, similar to what they just mentioned verbally.
Okay. Senator Meyer, did you have a question?
Nope.
Yes. Senator Fairclough? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that each of the items that our consultants have raised today has been brought to the attention of the chairman already. Senator Dunleavy, I met with the consultants and asked similar questions a while ago, same thing that you've done here today. So I think the chairman's aware of each of those issues.
Any other questions, comments? Thank you, gentlemen. That concludes SB 138 activities for the day, but now we're going to switch out to the co-chairman Meyer.
We take it an ease.
And we're going to take an ease while we do that, and the staff can switch everything out. We're at ease.
All right, we're going to bring Senate Finance back to order. We just have a couple bills that were previously heard that we'd like to see what the committee's wishes are. Shouldn't take too long. SJ 21 and SB 191. SJ 21 is the Constitutional Amendment Membership of Judicial Council. SJ 21 was, let's see. Well, first we need to get the CS before us, and we'll take a roll here again. We have Senator Kelly, Senator Olson, Senator Hoffman, Senator Dunleavy, Senator Faircloth, and myself, Senator Meyer. So do I have a motion to adopt the CS?
Mr. Chairman, I move that the committee adopt the CS version O for SJR 21 as our working document.
Okay, is there any objections to that CS being before us? Seeing hearing none, then the CS is before us. Senator Kelly, did you want to explain the changes, or your trusty staff, Heather?
Heather, could you do that?
Okay, Ms. Shattuck, if you would put your name on the record, please, and explain the new CS that's now before us.
For the record, my name is Heather Shattuck, staff to Senator Pete Kelly. The change can be found on page 2, lines 1 and 2. Version N, the original version stated, the Judicial Council shall act by a concurrence of a majority of its members who are participating in a vote. And that is changed in version O to say the Judicial Council shall act by a majority vote of a quorum of at least 7 members. And that is the only change in the CS.
Okay, questions? Okay, seeing none, any discussion, committee discussion? No? None? Senator Kelly?
Mr. Chairman, I'll make it quick because I've learned not to filibuster my own bills.
It's wise.
Mr. Chairman, I think our Constitution is a very fine document, but like all things in the world, it is not perfect. And one of the things that I think that the founding fathers in the Alaska State Constitution got wrong was the Judicial Council. Their desire was to depoliticize it, but unfortunately I don't think that is what has happened. I'm sure you've heard testimony. I was sick earlier in the, or last week when it was brought up, and we've been told that it is very rare for the people's will as represented through the non-public members on the Judicial Council, it is very rare for them to be overridden, and it's only happened a few times in the last 15 or last 30 years. The fact is that it's happened 4 times in the last 2 years on Supreme Court nominations, that the public members who are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the legislature have been overridden by the attorney members who are not confirmed by the legislature and are not appointed by any elected officials in the state. What happens is that the attorneys and the public members come to a tie, and we have seen multiple times that the Supreme Court justice, who is the tiebreaker in such a situation, will side with the attorney members to forward nominations to the governor. What we wanted to do was make sure that if we were going to have a system where essentially members of a guild are given such power to choose a branch of government, and they are not required to go through confirmation hearings like everyone else is. I mean, Board of Hairdressers has to go through confirmation hearings, but they don't. And the people that they nominate, those selections don't go through the confirmation hearing. That somewhere in there, we better make sure that the Constitution tethers this organization to the people in some way, and that we prevent, if we can, this tie vote scenario from happening where public members are overridden by people who never stand before the public, not for a single minute, for their confirmation. So the number of members was increased so that there were six public members and three attorney members. The three attorney members can still vote, but with a quorum of seven, there will never be a scenario where the public is against the attorneys, and if the Supreme Court justice has to come in and break a tie, there will never be a scenario where that Supreme Court justice is going against the people. There will have to, by the mathematics of it, there will have to be a representative of the people on both sides of whatever the nomination, whoever the nomination is. The other thing is that forgive me, Mr. Chairman, as I find it here in the Constitution, in Article 4, Section 8, when the Judicial Council is created in our Constitution, it says that there will be three attorney members, and they're appointed for six-year terms, and then there's three non-attorney members. They're appointed for six-year terms as well, but then they're subject to confirmation. Down at the bottom it says, appointments shall be made with due consideration to area representation and without regard to political affiliation. The problem is that there has been no real way to represent vast areas of the state with so few people. And so by increasing the number of public members, we'll at least have a shot at some regional diversity on this council. And if you look, I assume it's in your packet, but forgive me, Mr. Chairman, we've been kind of doing a lot of things on SB 138, and I may not be as prepared as I should be. I assume in your packet that you'll have a list of public and non-public members. Can I get just a brief and easy number, Mr. Chairman, so I can get that in front of me?
We're back. Senator Kelly.
So the Constitution says there shall be regional diversity, essentially. And then you go through the attorney members. Ketchikan, Juneau, Ketchikan, Fairbanks, Anchorage. Never. You don't get any rural members. Now, in the non-attorney members, you do get some rural people, but you have to go back to 1987 to get that. And before that, it's 1961. And it's a member from Point Barrow. Kotzebue in 61 and thank you. So the problem is that mathematically, I don't think anyone is trying to intentionally keep rural people out, but just mathematically, most of the attorneys are going to come from the urban areas. And we're just going to go year after year after year where we just simply cannot produce the regional diversity that the Constitution calls for, because there just aren't enough people on the public members. So the bill increases the public members. That's about all it does. Keeps us from having a conflict of interest, and it gives us a shot at regional diversification. And with that, I would urge members to vote this out of committee.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Kelly. Any other comments, questions? Okay. There is a small fiscal note attached. Obviously, there'll be a little additional cost with a larger council. So I think everybody has a copy of the fiscal notes. There's nothing else. Senator Kelly, do you make a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move SJR 21, a constitutional amendment for the membership of the Judicial Council, version O, from the Senate Finance Committee with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Is it version O or version N?
N.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, I'll revise that motion that we will move version N from committee.
Oh, version O.
Version O.
I had version O.
Let's take a brief at ease here. Yeah. Okay, we're back on record. Senator Kelly, if you could reread that motion for me, please.
Mr. Chairman, I move SJR 21, the constitutional amendment for membership of the Judicial Council, version O, from the Senate Finance Committee with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Okay. Any objections? Seeing here none, bill moves out of committee. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Okay, we'll take a brief at ease. All right, Senate Finance back to order. Next bill we'd like to discuss, Senate Bill 191, General Obligation Bond Fund Transfer. Again, we do have a CS on this. May I get a motion to adopt the CS? Senator Faircloth?
Chairman, I move the CS for Senate Bill Number 191, Finance 288-LS1483/N, dated 3-7-2014, before the committee.
Very good. Does everybody have that CS before them? Any objections to that CS before you? Seeing here none, and we do have the CS for Senate Bill 191 before us. We've already had the bill, had a hearing. Public testimony, we had opportunity for discussion. Senator Faircloth, I believe you're absent that night, but this is your brainchild. Appreciate you bringing this to the attention of the Finance Committee. So with that, Ms. Armstrong, will you explain the changes in the CS for us, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the Senate Finance Committee. Suzanne Armstrong, staff to Senator Meyer. There was a change to the title of the bill to reflect the authority of the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee and when that authority was necessary to approve the transfer of funds from the general fund to the construction funds. And then also on page 1 at line 12, it was clarified that it was the Commissioner of Administration that shall obtain approval of the transfer of funds. And then on page 2, line 8, it was clarified that it was the Commissioner of Administration that shall notify the LBNA committee when the transfer of money from the general fund to the construction funds had occurred.
Okay, very good. Questions for Ms. Armstrong? Seeing none. Okay, good job. Ms. Armstrong, committee discussion or questions? Not fiscal notes are zero. That's a good one. Okay, so with that, Chair will again thank Senator Faircloth for the bill, for the idea. And Senator Faircloth, do you have the motion?
Certainly. Mr. Chairman, I move from committee the CS for Senate Bill 191, Finance 28-LS1483/N, from committee with attached fiscal note and individual committee recommendations.
Okay, any objections? Seeing here none, bill moves out of committee. With that, let's take just a brief at ease. Okay, we're back. Just just wanted to confer with the co-chair here. We will meet again tomorrow at 9 o'clock. We will be taking up the Senate Bill 138 gas pipeline, and it's my guess that will be probably all we'll do tomorrow in the morning. So with that, if there's anything else to come before the committee, we're adjourned.